Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Humor Outcast Radio. I'm Donna Cavanaugh, and excuse me, I'm going to say excuse me in advance. I have a bit of a cold, so I hope I don't cough on everybody. Anyway, tonight we have part two. This was one of my most enjoyable interviews. I'm a journalist by background, so when I love doing interviewing humor, and don't get me wrong, but when I get back to my roots of regular, all different topics, and I got to interview Dr. Michael Harris, who is the author of Winning a Debate with an Israel Hater, How to Effectively Challenge Anti-Israel Extremists in Your Neighborhood. Shorehouse Books, my company, I'll say right out, published the book. And the book has been doing great. It's garnered a lot of attention and a lot of praise. And so I'm very happy to have Mike Harris with us again. Let me give you some background. He's one of the founders of San Francisco Voice for Israel, which is now the Bay Area chapter of Stand With Us. It founded in 2004. Excuse me. San Francisco Voice for Israel has countered anti-Israel demonstrations to provide the public and the media with an alternative to the lies being promoted by organizations such as International Answer and Jewish Voice for Peace. It also has done proactive public outreach at community events and brought pro-Israel speakers to the Bay Area. As part of Stand With Us, founded in 2001, the group is now part of a worldwide Israel education organization with chapters across the U.S. as well as in Europe and Australia. In his role with the group, Dr. Harris has made appearances on radio shows, both in the U.S. and Israel, television news reports, as a local spokesperson. He's given speeches to large groups at synagogues, churches, political organizations, and senior citizen centers throughout the Bay Area. In addition, he's been in the trenches standing up for Israel against anti-Israel demonstrators on the streets of San Francisco and Oakland for nearly a decade. In his spare time, he is a pediatrician in Marin County, California. So, Mike, are you with us? How are you?
Yes. Good evening, Donna.
And I'm so happy you came back for part two because we didn't get to cover a lot. Everyone says, "Oh, a half-hour show—that's a lot of time to carry." But as to talk, but as it turns out, more often than not, we run out of time.
Well, thank you for having me back. Really appreciate it.
So before we get going on, we might go back and I'll tell people and revisit some of the things we talked to, especially in light of what has happened since we last spoke, Paris, San Bernardino, things like that, the stabbing in London, all these things, this political climate that gets more intense. And I think it makes your point and your position so more relevant in the current climate. So I'd like to talk about that, and I really want to talk to you also about the book, how you got, what was the impetus for getting it done finally, and your inspirations for it. And so we have a lot to cover. So what do you want to start with?
Well, let's start with what I didn't really get to last time, which is exactly how I got to be writing this book. And you know, as you mentioned in that very generous introduction, I have been doing a lot of talks around the San Francisco Bay Area where I live for about 10 years. And I've been speaking mostly to pro-Israel groups and some neutral groups. And what I found in the course of these talks is basically educating people who already were supportive of Israel is that their hearts were absolutely in the right place, but they just didn't have the information they needed to counter a lot of the lies from the other side. For example, a statement that you might hear from one of these anti-Israel groups is that 5 million descendants of Palestinian refugees from Israel's War of Independence have a right in international law to return to Israel, and Israel's preventing them from doing so. Now, this is absolutely not true, and I go into the book in significant detail about exactly how you rebut that. But unless people have the facts, then they're not really able to hold up their end of the discussions. Certain other ones, such as, you know, Israel is an apartheid state. Well, I mean, anybody who has been there can certainly talk from their own individual perspective. There are no segregated beaches. There are no segregated buses for Jews only and Arabs only. Hospitals, you have Arab doctors treating Jewish patients. You have Jewish doctors treating Arab patients. You have Israeli Arab citizens who are in the military, who are diplomats, who are on Israel's Supreme Court. There have been Arabs in every single one of Israel's parliaments since the founding of the state. So, you know, but it's important for people to know this information. So what I found is that people really needed to have more of the facts at their disposal. And unfortunately, far too many of them were feeling, I guess, intimidated, reluctant to pick up really, really wonderful books like Alan Dershowitz's The Case for Israel or Dr. Mitchell Bard's Myths and Facts. And both of those are excellent books, and I specifically mentioned them as books that people should read after they read mine. And I said, okay, what's missing here? We need a step to get people more involved and engaged on the issue. And then I said, well, we need to write a book that's going to be a little bit more digestible and really cone the key facts down. And what helps people remember things a little bit better? A little bit of humor in there. So presenting it in somewhat of a satirical format, which includes a fair amount of making fun of the other side and their foibles, can really help make the book a lot more readable and a lot more accessible to people.
And it does. I mean, especially the humor aspect of it. I think when you first start talking about the book, people think, oh, my gosh, this is going to be so dry, so serious all the time. And when you go through the book, there is a good amount. It's not just, oh, a little bit here, a little bit there. You do have a lot of satire in it, which and satire is one of the best tools for teaching people. It just breaks down that intimidation factor and makes it more accessible to people. They don't quite feel, oh, I'll never get this. You know, you don't hit them that way. So the satire makes them retain the information more. So
exactly.
I can attest
and,
to that.
And, you know, yeah. Right. And you look at, you know, why is a political show like Bill Maher so widely watched and people pay attention to it? Because not only is it funny, but you also learn things while you watch. And so he's
right,
able to
right.
present the information, but in a way that makes it very, very memorable. Now, I don't claim to, you know, compare my own skills anywhere near on the scale of his, but certainly can say that that's an inspiration for what I have done.
That's right. Absolutely. And, you know, how many people have said in the past when Jon Stewart was doing his show that that's where
mm-hmm.
they always got their news from? And
that's right.
Because it was presented in a with a satirical point of view, and so it made people less intimidated to hear it or to engage with in the facts he presented or whatever. It just broke down a lot of barriers to people understanding and taking it in, and that's the beauty of humor. So I want to talk about this. When from the inspiration from when you said, I'm going to really do this, I'm going to write this book, to when we publish this book, how what kind of a time frame are we talking there? Was it just
it was,
like, I'm
yeah,
going to get
was
going
really
on it?
About 3 years, because I think I really sat down to write it after Israel was required to respond to, you know, the rocket assaults from Gaza in 2012 in that incursion. And I said, you know, there's a lot of hatred out on the streets because, of course, I went out and I saw a lot of it personally up close. And that people really needed a better source of information. So that particular round of war said to me, okay, now I need to really sit down and write something. And one of the inspirations also that came in around that time was a paired book of political humor. One was called How to Win a Fight with a Liberal, and the other one was called How to Win a Fight with a Conservative. And they were written by Dan Kurtzman, who actually lives local in the Bay Area. And so I want to, you know, give him a shout-out not only for his books, but a real significant thanks for really mentoring me as a first-time author through the writing process, because without his assistance, I doubt that I ever would have really finished the book.
See that? So do you believe in like a little bit of destiny and who you find along the way to make these things happen for you?
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, you do? Good. Okay.
sometimes when people are very devout in their politics or whatever, they don't, you know, they don't go for that. But see, that's good. I like to hear that.
Yeah, no, I definitely have to give him a lot of credit. Again, not only for realizing, like, wait a second, that is perhaps, you know, the angle I can take, but for being available to me and really helping me through the process.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's always good when you have some, because it could have gotten lost. It could have gotten lost in just your daily life, or if you cooled down a little bit and said, oh, I don't have time for this, I have a practice, I can't deal with this. A lot of it could have gotten lost, and here was this guy who was, you know, well-established in his own right and taking the time, and so I think that's an amazing thing, and it brought the help to bring the book to life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what other influences, is it hard... Is one of the influences for this, was it hard for you to personally see all the attacks on Israel? You seem like, and I guess it's like almost it's a personal affront for you when you see all these things. But what makes it different that you actually took the stand this way? A lot of other people don't. They just say, oh, forget it, I don't want to get involved. So what made you, what propelled you to saying, I have to do this?
Sure. I have a statement I can make when I give talks that is absolutely true, because I can say my father was a Palestinian. Because my father was born in Tel Aviv in 1928 under the British Mandate of Palestine. And at that time, there was basically two terms for the people who lived there. The Jews were the ones who were referred to as Palestinians, and the Arabs were called Arabs. So those are the two peoples. And if you look at news reports, look at the old Pathé newsreels. They talk about the Arabs, and when they talk about the Palestinians, they mean the Jews. So in the language of that time, my father was a Palestinian. So he lived there until he was seven, and then his father picked up the family and moved them to New York in time to join the Great Depression. I guess he didn't want to get left out of that. So I do have, you know, that personal history. Some of it is in my DNA. Some of it is in the way that I was raised. And then, you know, when a lot of the anti-Israel sentiment in the Bay Area took to the streets in 2004 when we started SF Voice for Israel, there were a number of us who were all of the activist bent who came together and said, we're the ones who are going to stand up and do something here. So, you know, that's not for everybody, but we certainly, you know, found a good core group of people here, and we were able to attract other people who felt it was necessary. And you do point out correctly that for most Jews, the great majority of Jews, we do see these as attacks on ourselves. There's a saying in Hebrew, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LaZeh, which means all of Israel looks out for one another. Mm-hmm. And that's really the way we feel, because one of the misconceptions about this conflict is that it's about land, that it's about territory, and that if Israel, for example, were to move back to the 1949 armistice line, sometimes called the 1967 borders, though they were never recognized as borders by Arab states, that would end the conflict. But Israel's offered to do that three times already. Recently, and all those offers have been rebuffed. And the other side is extraordinarily clear that it's not about 1967. It's about 1948, because they don't accept the existence of a Jewish state within any borders whatsoever. And so this is what the conflict is about, not whether there should be a Palestinian Arab state, but whether there should be a Jewish state there.
Huh, interesting. And you know what's very interesting as well is that you talked about it when you first started the show, is that Arabs and Jews work together. They're doctors, they're in parliament. In every walk of life, Arabs and Jews work together. So when you're in Israel, what is the climate between Arab and Jew? Is it mostly that everybody gets together, or is it mostly that they're always at odds with each other? What is that climate?
Well, it can vary. And, you know, there's a political spectrum among Israeli Jews. There's a political spectrum among Israeli Arabs. And, you know, a fair number of Israeli Arabs vote for what are called the Zionist parties. In other words, the regular mainstream parties. Not all of them vote for the Arab parties that came together as what was called the Joint Arab List. And, you know, you will find people of varying opinions, but there are clearly many, many, many Arab citizens of Israel who are loyal to the country. There's, and I'm forgetting her name, unfortunately, there's a wonderful young Israeli Arab woman who is a TV anchor woman on one of Israel's main news stations. And she absolutely is a loyal, patriotic Israeli and criticizing other members of her community who are saying things that are rather extremist. So, you know, there's a spectrum of opinion. Now, you know, are Israeli Arab citizens equal socioeconomic status to that of the Jewish population? Well, it's very interesting because the highest demographic in Israel in terms of both education and income is the Christian Arab population.
Huh.
And
That shocked me. I didn't know that.
And the Muslim Arab population and the ultra-Orthodox Israeli Jewish population are both at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, and there are various cultural reasons for that. And, you know, there are minorities in every country, and every country, including the United States, including Canada, has minorities that are not getting necessarily a fair share of the economic pie. But, you know, the way you address that is within the country itself and educational opportunities and giving a hand up to people. But, you know, they are certainly part of the fabric of the country.
So do you think, well, you were just talking about in every country, in every society, we're just in the United States, even in Canada, they're more melting pots. Everybody comes in. Sure, we have our fair share of issues, but for the most part, people learn to get along. Do you think that's a hindrance when people are asked to look at the Israel-Palestinian, whatever you want to call it, conflict? Or do you think that's a help? Because some countries that are so homogeneous that there's just one culture, just one thing, they have no idea what it's like to have to give other people part of the economic pie. So do you think it goes against it, or do you think it helps when you have people? But in the Bay Area, you have these people who are so anti-Israel. So I don't know. It confounds me. I just get confused by the whole thing. Like, why so much hatred toward this idea from people who live in a country that is used to a melting pot type of thing?
Well, but Israel, quite honestly, really isn't a melting pot. And to quote one of my favorite authors, Dr. Daniel Gordis, Israel is not simply a Hebrew-speaking, falafel-eating version of the United States. The United States, the American people are a melting pot. The Canadian people are a melting pot, okay? But the Japanese are not. The Chinese are not. The Indians are not. Right. So many countries in the world are nation states of a certain peoples. And Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people and will remain so. So while the minority populations there absolutely should and do have voting rights, civil rights, legal rights equal to that of the Jewish population, Israel's purpose in existing is not to be a melting pot. It is to be the nation state of the Jewish people in the same way that Italy is the nation state of the Italian people and Egypt is the nation state of the Egyptian people.
So where do you see this after all your work and in trying to influence people to see that how important this is? What is your absolute goal with this, and how do you see yourself and your groups getting there to make this happen?
Sure. The goal is education, because educating people is the key to peace. That's actually one of the mottos of Stand With Us. And the more that people know about the situation at least in the United States, the more they side with Israel. I actually cite a Gallup poll from last summer's Operation Protective Edge. And I cite that because it was very, very revealing. It shows that the more that people had read about the conflict or heard about it on the radio or seen TV news reports, the more they sided with Israel. So our goal is basically within the United States and the West maintaining the support for Israel that exists. American support for Israel over the past decade consistently runs at 60 to 70%. And our goal is to maintain the status quo. Now, what we see on the other side is they want to change the status quo. They want to change the fact that there is a nation state of the Jewish people because they are vociferously opposed to that, and only for the Jewish people, not for the Palestinians or any others, only for the Jews.
So why do you think that is, though? That's what confuses a lot of people. Why are so many people, the people that you rally against, why are they so anti-Jewish state but not anti-Palestinian Arab state?
Well, you know, the core argument right there that they're opposed to a state of the Jewish people and only the Jewish people while supporting it for other peoples, including the Palestinian Arabs, who did not really appear on the world stage with any kind of national consciousness until a little over 100 years ago, while the Jews have been a people for 3,000 years. So that
right.
core argument to say only the Jews as a people don't get to have that right of national self-determination, that core argument is anti-Semitic. Now, this is not to say that everyone who is, you know, standing out there opposing Israel's policies is an anti-Semite. Far from it. Israel has a very, very vibrant political discourse and much disagreement with policies of the government. But it's a far stretch to go from I'm disagreeing with what Israel is doing to therefore it should not exist
right.
as a nation.
And
yeah.
it does.
So
and that argument, that side of the coin always makes that leap. It's not like, can we bring this back? Can you try and compromise more? It goes to the absolute extreme, well, there shouldn't be an Israel. And
right.
it's weird to me that that is the only country to do that. And I know this is like apples and oranges, but I look at, and I'm from an Italian background, and I look at the mob situation, and that people went, and nobody said, oh, gee, all these people came from Italy, therefore nobody said, let's get rid of Italy to deal with this problem as it grows,
right.
growing and growing and growing. So why is it that Israel is the only country where people say, okay, let's get rid of it then? It doesn't
yes,
exist.
And again, unfortunately, anti-Zionism, that political stance to say we oppose Israel's existence, is the modern, more politically correct expression of anti-Semitism. And you'd actually mentioned at the top of the show some of the things that we've seen happen just since the last time we talked, you know, the massacre
right.
in Paris and in San Bernardino, you know, what we're seeing happening worldwide. Israel really is a test for Western values and Western civilization. Israel is a country that shares our values, political rights, civil rights, women's rights, rights of free religion to worship your God in any way you choose. There is no restriction on religious rights in Israel, unlike all of the surrounding countries. And the hatred directed against Israel by the extreme jihadi forces that are out there, in part is Jew hatred, and in part is hatred of the values that we here as Americans live with and support. And Israel really is on the front line of this struggle. So anybody who wants to say, well, we need to be able to stop this, you know, extremist radical Islamism from infecting Europe and the United States, Israel is right out there, and those folks who are concerned about it should be strongly in support of Israel.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And do you see that when things like horrible things like that have happened in the past month, do you see that swing a little bit more toward your way, your views, or do you see it, you know, being like a boomerang and saying, I'm done with everything in the Mideast?
You know, it's hard to say because, you know, in these particular events here, people are much more appropriately focused on, especially after San Bernardino, you know, what's going on in our local communities. But
right.
I think there is certainly a heightened awareness that this is the type of threat that Israel faces every single day.
Every day.
Right. If you look at what Israel faced in Arafat's terror war that he launched in 2000, in terms of the size of the population and the number of casualties, Israel went through, I believe it was about a dozen 9/11s over a period of a few years relative to the size of its population.
Yeah. It's amazing. Like, you don't, it's hard when you're not in that country, you're not in that space, you lose perspective of what actually goes on. You know, you don't.
That's right.
And nobody
and anybody who's been to Israel, anybody who's been there anytime recently has been in the range of Hamas or Hezbollah rockets, anywhere you are in the country. And so it gives you a perspective on things, and then you understand, you know, what they are up against, and the fact that they have been able to do this with, as Colonel Richard Kemp, former commander of British forces in Afghanistan, described as more care to avoid civilian casualties than any army in the history of modern warfare. The fact that they face this and they warn civilian populations by calling cell phones and dropping leaflets that there's a building there that Hamas has taken over for its operations and we're going to bomb that building, so you need to get out of there. Who does that?
Huh.
Who does that? You know? And the answer is Israel does.
Yeah. Amazing. And look, see, and once again, we're out of time. But I want to tell people to, once again, the book, it's by Dr. Michael Harris, and you can get it on Amazon.com and other online retail stores. It is called Winning a Debate with an Israel Hater, and it's doing wonderfully. I mean, I think you've gotten so much attention from people and making them think. And I think that, and I applaud that. I think that's amazing that you took a topic that so many people didn't know about, and it's getting a lot of, it's making people think, which I guess is what you really want them to do. As you
said,
education.
Absolutely, because the more they know and the more they think about it, the more they're going to end up understanding and supporting what Israel is doing. So I hope to have the opportunity to come on again and talk with you at some point in the near future.
And you will. After the new year, I'm going to invite you back so we can go over it and do some more talking about it because I think it's important. Also, I want to tell people that next week on Humor Outcast, we will be excerpting the book. And we will have also both interviews up side by side, or one below the other, however it works on, so that you can hear both interviews with Dr. Michael Harris. Mike, thank you so much for joining me again.
You're quite welcome, Donna. Thank you for all your assistance. Take care.
Bye-bye.